Let's generate our motivation. And so let's contemplate how we're conditioned phenomena. Our body is conditioned, it's produced by causes and conditions. Our consciousness, our mind is conditioned, produced by its causes and conditions. The I that's merely labeled in dependence upon these is also conditioned. We're influenced by external things. We're influenced by the past. We're influenced by our present conceptions. So there's no kind of independent agent there. There's no I who is in control of the situation. When we're practicing the Dharma, we're not trying to invent an I that's in control, because no such thing exists or can ever exist. But we're trying to learn to work with causality, cause and effect, interdependence, conditioning. So it's wisdom that cuts down this idea of a controller and thus liberates us from samsara. And it's our precepts that also show us how we're conditioned and dependent and interrelated. Because the precepts act as a mirror to show us all these different causes and conditions and thoughts and actions within our own body and mind. And the precepts are showing us how to condition ourselves in a more suitable way. They're not showing us how to control ourselves, but how to condition ourselves. And so this whole conditioning process helps us to realize the higher trainings in ethical discipline, concentration, wisdom, and of course, bodhicitta, where we're seen as so interdependent with others. And so as part of this process of self-conditioning, let's generate the bodhicitta motivation, so that we can take the Dharma in, take the Vinaya in, and use it on the path to enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. So this whole thing about realizing how we're conditioned and seeing ourselves as a dependent phenomena, not as an independent, inherently existent person who's in charge of the whole thing, is very, very important. Okay. And we can see how it fits into wisdom. We can see how it fits into just the keeping of precepts too. Yeah, because we're influenced by our external environment, so we choose to keep the precepts because they condition us in another way. Of course, not all the conditioning from our external environment is negative. The 37 practices, it talks about the benefits of being around a spiritual mentor and about being around spiritual friends. So we can have positive conditioning from the outside too. We don't need to be afraid of the world. Okay. And when negative thoughts arise in our mind, we don't need to see them as inherently existent things to fight with, but to remember that they're conditioned also, that they have causes, that they arise due to conditions, and so that anything that is causal, you know, is impermanent, it's transient, it fades away, and it has no nature of its own. Okay, so when various thoughts arise in our mind, instead of saying, oh, I had anger, this is terrible, you know, I've got to fight it, this anger is going to kill me and destroy my attempts for happiness, you know, and going into overdrive and, you know, like that. Because you know how we talk to ourselves sometimes. To just recognize, okay, anger has arisen due to causes and conditions. It's arisen due to causes and conditions. When that causal energy ceases, the anger is going to cease. It's an impermanent phenomenon. There's no inherently existent anger there. No demon that's going to gobble me up. You know, it's just a thought. It's not real. I can let it go. You know, and I don't need to fight with it and clobber it over the head and, you know, go on an all-out war against myself because I had an angry thought. Now, I can apply the antidotes and, you know, have a way of reconditioning my mind to see the situation in another way. And that kind of, reconditioning of my own mind calms down that anger and prevents the anger from rising again. But we shouldn't get into any kind of internal civil war. That is not Dharma practice. Okay? Repeat, because we are slow learners, you know. When we're in civil war, that is not Dharma practice. Okay? Because what's happening in civil war is there's this conception of a big fat me who is in charge, or who isn't in charge but should be in charge, right? Don't you have that? You know, when there's internal war, it's like, oh, there was a thought of attachment. How can I have this thought of attachment? I'm out of control. I'm not in control of my mind. I've got to be in control because I am king of my own mind. So I've got to clobber this attachment. Womp, 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 womp. Yeah. And so we're walking around all day like, you know, dragging ourselves from one thing to the other because, you know, we're going womp, womp, womp the whole time. You know? And of course all of our friends are looking around at us, like, what's wrong with you? You know, you look so miserable, you're so uptight. But we don't realize it, and we're thinking, oh, I'm doing just like Shanti Deva said, I'm fighting the delusions. You know, and it's got to, you know, for Shanti Deva, this warlike thing, you know, it's a real guy thing, and a guy analogy, you know, fight the delusions. You know, take out your weapons of mass destruction. Go for those delusions. It's a battle for life and death. You know, but, you know, maybe that analogy works for some people, but I don't know. I think for us, you know, in America, you know, with our culture, that analogy is open to so much misinterpretation, isn't it? You know, where we have this idea of, you know, there's the president, and because we're the one superpower, we've got to be in charge. Who's going to, you know, make everybody comply to what we want? And we do the same in our mind. There's the president, me, you know, and I'm fighting myself, and I'm going to clobber myself and fight with myself until I am victorious because I am the superpower in myself. Well, you know, that's totally against the whole teaching on emptiness, isn't it? Isn't it? It's totally the opposite of emptiness. Emptiness is saying there is no superpower I in there. Who's the big controller? Who's the big boss who's going to be in charge? Yeah. Instead, there's just all these different mental factors and all this different conditioning. And, you know, we've got to kind of learn to manage it and flow with it and go with it and use it in a conducive way without being petrified by these impermanent phenomena that arise in our minds sometimes. No, so the whole idea of taking precepts isn't to make us more uptight. I mean, we are uptight enough as it is, aren't we? Okay? We don't need to be more uptight. And we are so dualistic that we think, oh, if I'm not uptight, then I'll just, you know, go for it and self-indulge. Okay? And so we're so full of fear of self-indulging that then we get over uptight, you know. And so we vacillate between one extreme and the other, don't we? You know, we either starve ourselves or we pig out. You know? And it's the same in so many areas of our life. We're just, you know, so dualistic. Yeah? So I think we're going to integrate some wisdom in here to realize, you know, that the precepts are not martial law. Okay? Don't look at your precepts and your guidelines as martial law that, you know, you've got to impose upon yourself. There's no compassion in that, you know, and no wisdom in that either. So it's just, okay, these are guidelines. I'm trying to condition myself and condition my body, condition my speech, condition my emotions and my thoughts to go in this direction. So we're just reconditioning ourselves. Okay, that's what meditation is. It's not about controlling, it's about reconditioning. Okay? And so, of course, reconditioning is going to take some time. And that's why we need to have some compassion for ourselves. Okay. Now, of course, we hear compassion for ourselves, and instead of understanding compassion properly, we go to the other extreme and we think, compassion for myself, poor me. Look at what a mess I am. I have so much compassion in the world. I have compassion for me, too, because I'm a mess. Okay. You know, we go from one extreme to the next, don't we? You know, and compassion is wishing ourselves to be free of suffering and its causes. Yeah? So we have compassion for ourselves, and we're trying to recondition ourselves in that way. And we have some kind of self-acceptance in this process. Okay? And self-acceptance doesn't mean we don't try and change. It simply means we accept what's going on right now. Because anyway, what's going on right now is going on. It's already happening. So we can't recondition something that's happening. We can only recondition things that haven't happened. So we've got to accept the present, what's happening. And at the same time, do the reconditioning for what hasn't happened yet in the future. Okay, so we don't fall into self-pity, and we don't, like, squeeze ourselves. Yeah, Lama Yeshe was really an expert in detecting that in us. You know, I mean, how we Westerners, we just got so many trips. And he would just lambast us about this. Yeah. There was one monk who... Now, we had, in the rooms we lived on, the floor was like brick. Okay, so it was really cold. And, you know, sometimes we could get some kind of mattresses, you know, some thin foam mattress or something and put that on the floor. But there was this one monk that I think he was trying to practice these ascetic practices. So he got a straw mat, not even a straw mattress, a straw mat, and put it on the floor. And Lama, he would come and check out our rooms, you know. You didn't hide anything from Lama. I mean, some Geshe's or Rinpoche's just sit in their room all day, you know. Lama, yes, he didn't. He walked around, he saw what you were doing, he opened your drawers, you know. He knew what was going on. And I remember he walked into this monk's room and, "Who do you think you are, Milarepa?" You know, "Are you doing some kind of Milarepa trip here? You're not Milarepa. Go get yourself a mattress." And of course, this monk thought that, you know, he was practicing so well, and, you know, he was really going to be Milarepa. Okay. So we need, you know, some kind of ease and balance in our practice. And I think learning how to be a balanced human being is definitely part of Dharma practice. In fact, I make that the core of my Dharma practice because, you know, if we're out of whack, nothing else can happen. But, you know, we're really stuck. And so I think just learning to be in balance is, you know, a very good goal of our Dharma practice. And, of course, balance changes from moment to moment, doesn't it? It's not like you find an inherently existent balance point and you do that for the rest of your life. No. Everything's changing all the time. So we're constantly, you know, rebalancing ourselves here. Okay? But I think the more we can be in balance and have some sense of self-acceptance, then the less negative karma we're going to create. Because we're not going to be so uptight. When we're not so uptight, we're not going to lose our temper. Because what makes us lose our temper? We get so uptight. Yeah? Okay? So, you can see how karma is, the creation of the karma, that, you know, is intimately linked to, you know, whether we're relaxed or whether we're squeezing ourselves and involved in internal civil war. I can see this rang some bells somewhere in the audience. Ding, ding. Okay, so today I'm really going to try and talk about the evolution of the Sangha historically, you know, because I think this is really interesting and it tells us a little bit about how the Buddha set things up, and actually what an organic process the evolution of the Sangha was. You know, it wasn't like the Buddha said, "Okay, I'm enlightened, I'm going to set up the Sangha, what rules do I need to have? Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, what kind of organizational structure do I need? 1, 2, 3, 4, what kind of punishments do I need? 1, 2, 3, 4. No, this was not the way the Buddha did it, okay? The Buddha went out, he taught, you know, as we saw, some people got really turned on by what he was saying and they wanted to practice. And, you know, since this whole thing of having a samana community was societally accepted in India and there were so many different groups, then people requested the Buddha to become one of his followers. He said, "Come, O bhikkhu," and that was it. Okay, and so there were no precepts for the first 12 years. Yeah, there were no precepts for the first 12 years. They just practiced, you know. Buddha gave teachings, and they practiced. And then the precepts came into being because slowly people started to do things that other people complained about. And I can't remember exactly, I should know this exactly. I think the first one was about sexual intercourse. Okay? How that came up. And these stories are very interesting. There's really something behind it. So, you know, in ancient India, you know, every guy was supposed to have a son. You know, it was like so important to have a son that you passed everything on to. So this one monk had ordained, you know, and he didn't have any kids. And he was living as a monk, and everything was great. And his wife came, because she was still living with her in-laws, his parents, and said, you know, we don't have any kids, and your parents really want a kid, because you're an only kid, and they need kids to, this is like, you know, societal pressure, we got to have a kid. And so, you know, will you just sleep with me? I'll get pregnant, have a kid, and then, you know, the in-laws will leave me alone. So he did. Yeah. And when the Buddha heard about this, the Buddha said, foolish monk, you know, what do you think you're doing? Yeah. And I thought that this was an extremely interesting story, because it wasn't like the monk was overpowered by lust and, you know, jumped on top of somebody. It was like somebody presented him with this argument that in Indian social society would seem to be a reasonable argument, and one in which he could say to himself, oh, I'm doing this for the benefit of my parents. Yeah? It wasn't that he just lost control. It's like he had some kind of reason, and even, you know, weird reason, you know, if I'm going to do it for the benefit of my parents. So I thought that this story is the initial story, you know, is interesting because it's illustrating, you know, that even in situations where you think it might be to benefit somebody, sexual intercourse is not permitted. You know, let alone times when you're just bonkers, you know, your mind's out of control. But even in this kind of situation, it isn't allowed. And like the precept for against killing, the story behind it was that, you know, because in the mindfulness of the body, there's all these meditations about meditating on the filthiness of the body and the ugly aspect of the body. And it's extremely effective, as I was telling you, for controlling desire. And so there was this one monk who was just meditating so much about, you know, the ugly aspect of the body that he went overboard and began to loathe his body. So instead of just using the meditation to subdue attachment to the body, he went to the extreme and started loathing his body, which is not the purpose of the meditation. Okay? So he started to hate his body so much that he went to another monk and said, please kill me. I can't stand to have this body. Okay? So the other monk said, you know, this guy saying, please, you know, relieve me of my suffering and just kill me. And so this other monk did. And so when the Buddha heard about it again, he said, foolish monk. And I think this is, again, a very interesting story. It wasn't that killing is prohibited just because somebody lost it and got so jealous or angry that they just went bonkers and killed somebody. But again, he was requested and he thought, oh, out of compassion for this person, I should kill him. And he asked me to. So he, you know, and so I think, you know, the Buddha's showing even in that kind of situation, let alone when you're angry, but even in a situation where somebody asks you, where you aren't angry, where you think you could be doing it for compassion, it's not allowed. Yeah? So you know, I think these stories are quite interesting that way. Or the one about lying, okay, lying of spiritual attainments. What happened was there was a famine in the land. And so the monks, when they went out on Pindapat to gather their alms, people didn't have any, they had so little food. So they were keeping the food for themselves. So, the monks didn't have very much to eat. And, of course, the population didn't have very much to eat. So the monks, so, you know, there was one monk who, at the end of the rainy season, was very plump and looked very healthy and well-fed. And the other one said, hey, look at us, you know. We're really skinny and we've been eating this rotten food. How come you look so healthy? And he said, you know, well, I was told the people that I had actualized the, you know, the jhana states. You know, the levels of the various levels of samadhi. And so he had, you know, just told them that he had these realizations that he didn't have. And so, of course, the lay people out of such faith said, you know, oh, his life is very valuable if he has these realizations. His life is more important than mine. I will definitely feed him. Okay, and so that's how he got his food. And so when the Buddha heard about this, again, he said, foolish monk, you know. And I thought, again, this story is very telling. It's not just that the guy was intoxicated, you know, with arrogance, but he was lying about his own attainments in a serious case, just trying to keep his body healthy and stay alive. And even in that kind of case, the Buddha said, no, you don't lie about your spiritual attainment. Yeah? So it's interesting, isn't it? You know, the stories aren't just about how we would envision ourselves, or the typical person envision themselves just losing control of their mind and lying. They're about, you know, so implied in this is, you know, forget the time. I mean, let alone those times when you're losing control, definitely, you know, you've got to, like, try and manage your mind and just not, you know, kind of go bonkers. But even in these situations where somebody asks you or where there seems to be a good reason for it, also it's not permitted. So I thought, very, very interesting. Okay, so for the first 12 years, there were no precepts. And then gradually, people, you know, began to act in outrageous ways. And if you read the Vinaya stories, some of what the Buddha's disciples did is absolutely shocking. I mean, totally shocking. And if you think things are degenerate now, you know, what some of the disciples did at the time of the Buddha, it's just unbelievable. You know, there was this, I mean, what, I'll tell you one story. There was one monk who was living out in the forest, and another monk came to stay with him. And he noticed that, you know, that this monk, he would, you know, go and in the village, and he would get his food and come back, and he would eat his food, and then he would leave some food out for the monkeys. And there was one female monkey who would come and, you know, eat the food. And then, what was it? I don't know if she ate the food first or hung around. Do you remember? She hung around first and ate the food later. And what happened was the monk would have sex with this female monkey and then give her the food, or it was he gave her the food and she would hang around and then he would have sex with her. But it was, you know, definitely Pavlovian, you know, the conditioning here. You know, so then, of course, the Buddha had to, you know, make another, you know, include in the celibacy precept, it also means not with animals and not with dead bodies, because some other monk was making it with a dead body. And, you know, so it was quite interesting. So it's quite interesting to read these stories. Okay, but in any case, the whole, you know, the whole Pratimoksha was developed because people made mistakes. And it was brought to the attention to the Buddha, and then the Buddha made a precept. And as the story goes, I'm not sure if I believe this literally, sometimes I'm not so good because I think that maybe it's... Yeah, but according, there were six monks who were the naughty ones, you know, and because of those six, we have all the vows. But the teachers say it's actually due to the kindness of those six monks, you know, that we then have it, because, you know, they help the Pratimoksha get developed. And so then the nuns, we got all of the monks' vows that arose from the monks' mistakes, and then there were six nuns, and so they made some more mistakes, so we got the precepts that came from their mistakes. Of course, the monks didn't get the precepts that came from the nuns' mistakes. But we got all of them, which was, you know, four far more than the nuns made themselves. But anyway, it doesn't matter. So that's why the nuns have more precepts than the monks do. Okay? But it evolved very, very gradually. Like I said, in the first 12 years, there weren't any precepts at all. Okay? And so at the beginning, you know, the Sangha was just this very loose community. You know, they lived under trees, they went out for alms, they wore rags, a very, very loose community. Not, you know, there wasn't the Pratimoksha rules, there wasn't the Sojung, the Posada ceremony, you know, the twice a month confession. None of these things were going on. And the Buddha just wandered and gave teachings, you know, different teachings according to different audiences. Well, as things happen, you know, in the rainy season, you know, in the summer months in India, you get the monsoon rains. And there are so many bugs and insects at that time. And so when the monks and nuns were going around, you know, gathering their alms and wandering, they were killing a lot of bugs during this time because they were walking. They were trampling the rice fields that were trying to grow during the monsoons. They were probably getting sick because of all of this as well, because it's easy to get sick during monsoon time. And so, you know, when people started saying to the Buddha, your disciples are still walking during all this time, you know, and they're killing beings, and why is this going on? So then the Buddha started the thing called Vasa, or the summer retreat, or it's also called the rainy season retreat. And so at this time, then the Sangha, for the period of 3 months, although there has subsequently come to be where you could do a shorter version for 6 weeks, for 3 months took some additional precepts and stayed in one place, and they didn't go out, and instead food was brought to them. And so what happened is there became what's called a Vasas and a Ramas. Okay. Now, I had already mentioned this before about how some of the wealthy people had donated land, and how even here at the Abbey we named two of our areas, you know, Vasakas Grove and not Pindika's Grove, after the two of the benefactors who donated to the Sangha at the time of the Buddha, Shravasti. Okay, so what happened is, you know, as you began to have these donations, then during the rainy season's retreat, the Sangha would gather at some of these places that had been donated to the Sangha, and they began to be called Aramas, okay? And then they also gathered at other places, because the idea of the rainy season retreat was to live together and practice together, and it also made it easier for the lay people who offered food to the Sangha to just come to one place. So some of the monks would gather in places in the forest or other places that hadn't been donated because, you know, they didn't have the, you know, so much land ownership now and trespassing rules and all this kind of stuff like we have at the moment. And so those became temporary structures that the monks themselves built where they lived during the 3 months of the rainy season's retreat. So the aramas were the ones that were offered by donors, and then after the monks left, and the nuns, because I guess the nuns were doing this too, after the monastics left, after the Vasa period was over, then at the aramas, the wealthy benefactors continued the upkeep of the buildings, and some of those buildings became temporary. At the avasas, because they were buildings that the monks made, then some of them fell into disarray, and they had to be, you know, rebuilt afterwards and so on. But from here, you know, so at the beginning, you know, everybody would stay put for 3 months and then after that they would resume the wandering. Well, then since every summer you were going to be staying put, People, of course, were creatures of habit. They developed the habit of going back to the same place every year. So while everybody may not have gone back to the same place, enough of a group started coming back to the same place as to start forming like a little group, a little cohesive group. They, you know, they knew each other better. And so because the same, you know, when it came to distributing rooms for the time of the Vasa, the people who came back to the same place every year would have priority about the rooms that they got because they were the ones who kept coming back. Okay? And so from there what happened is that after Vasa, then not everybody left. Some people would leave and some would stay behind. Okay? So you had... And this started even at the time of the Buddha. You had this gradual process of somehow the monastics becoming more and more settled. Okay? So it went from being wandering to being settled for monsoon, and you stay there only for the 3 months of the Vasa, and then you wander. And then the next stage was you would return to the same place each year. Okay? And then, you know, you would start getting some privileges at that place when it came to handing out rooms because you came back each year. And then the next step was that you wouldn't leave between monsoons, so you would kind of stay there all year round. But even at this point, it was still a very, very loose group of monks. They were just living at the same place, doing their own practice. They weren't necessarily... you know, living in a, you know, with a lot of organization between them. They were more just, everybody was doing their practice, get your alms, and that was it. Okay? And then slowly the next step after that was they began, because, you know, they not only came back every year, but they were living there all the time, they began to be recognized as like a little miniature sangha. Because initially when the Buddha set up the sangha, it was called the Sangha of the Ten Directions. Or was it the Four Directions? I can't remember how they... Maybe it was the Four Directions, okay? So, meaning that it was all of the monastics, you know? So the sangha included everybody. That, you know, all the monastics, wherever they were. And that was kind of the ideal sangha, the whole collection, you know? But gradually, as you started to have these settled communities, they began to become their own little sanghas, okay? And so they began to develop more of an organizational structure. At first, they didn't have one. But then, of course, human beings, when we live together, then, you know, they develop their own little internal rules and internal structures, okay? And then because the... lay people would bring food to these places, then they also, after some time, weren't just, you know, small places where they practiced and weren't just small organizational structures, but they began to be places where the lay people would also come. Okay? And so they became independent centers of monastic life, each with their own field of lay supporters around them. Okay? So what you find is, you know, just starting at the time of the Buddha with settling with Vasa, and then slowly afterwards, over the centuries, the Sangha getting more and more settled. And this happened actually relatively quickly. So even within, you know, a few centuries of the Buddha's life, you know, you're having these settled communities. And so as things happen, you know, things get more and more settled and more organized and structured, and because that's the way we human beings are. Okay? So that kind of happens slowly and gradually, and you have these small groups, and as Buddhism spread all over India, you began to have the small groups of Sangha all over the place. Okay? I mean, Buddhism started in the north, you know, and around the Ganges River and there, and then it spread to the south. It started going over into Afghanistan and into Persia. You know, it went, in later centuries, it went over the Kashgar Pass, am I saying it right? The Kashgar Mountains into Central Asia and up through the Silk Road And it went down into Southeast Asia, even as far as Indonesia. You see Borobudur, this enormous stupa in Indonesia. So, you know, Buddhism began to spread, you know, in many directions. It first went to Sri Lanka. That was the first spreading, and that was by Ashoka's son and daughter, who were a bhikshu and a bhikshuni. And that was about, when did Ashoka live? 3rd century B.C.? Right? 3rd century? Okay. And so he sent his son and daughter, and his daughter brought a branch of the Bodhi tree with, and, you know, started, you know, both, and they started both the Bhikshu and the Bhikshuni Sangha in Sri Lanka. Okay? And then some of this transmission was going on in the A.D. centuries as well. I mean, certainly Buddhism didn't go to Tibet until the 6th century, so that was, you know, pretty much later on. Okay, but just in India itself, let's go back to India, you know, you had this gradual evolution of the monasteries. And so monasteries became kind of practice centers, you know. You practice, you recite the sutras, because, as, you know, right after the Buddha passed away, they had the first council where they recited everything everybody had heard. Okay, so it was Ananda who recited all the sutras because he was the Buddha's attendant, so he heard more than anybody did. So when it says, thus have I heard, it's Ananda speaking, okay, and he's relating what he heard. And then Upali recited the Bhikshu Vinaya. And I don't, you know, they always say that Upali recited the Vinaya. But, you know, in thinking about it, And it's always that the 500 arhats were males. But there must have been some female arhats because the monks would not have known the Bhikshuni Pradimoksha to recite it. Okay? But somehow it said Upali recited, you know, the Pradimoksha, and that started the Vinaya. Okay? So a lot of the history we hear, I think, is kind of legend and, you know, and it's history and legend combined. That can be so
heretical.
Thank you. That was the word I was looking for. As to, you know, to mention this. But for myself, I think it's helpful to see the development of Buddhism within a society as having a history, you know, and a history that, of course, gets codified. And as all history is, having been a history major, it's not the extent of everything that happened, yeah. And how much and you see in the sutras themselves all the repetitions of certain passages in many sutras. They have the same passages repeated over and over. And surely the Buddha didn't say the exact same words over and over. But it makes sense if you codify those passages because it becomes easier to memorize. And it becomes easier to make sure everybody's on the same page if, you know, the jhanas are always described as this. And Buddha's, you know, the evening before enlightenment is always described like this. Okay, and so that makes sense considering that it was a tradition that was orally passed down for, you know, at least 4 or 5 centuries before it even began to be written down, let alone finished being written down. Okay, it was all passed down orally. Okay, so the initial monastics, you know, another thing that happened when they were living together was not just practicing, but they would pass down the sutras and that they had memorized from one to the other. So they became centers, you know, mostly of memorization and learning because very few people read and wrote at that time. You know, reading and writing just was not popular. It was all orally transmitted. And so it wasn't until the 1st century that things began to be written down, usually like on palm leaves or bamboo leaves or something like that. So, you know, that wasn't the greatest, it wasn't like, you know, on a CD, it you know, a palm leaf, you know, I don't know how long it could last. It probably didn't last very long, and the scriptures disintegrated. Okay, so then the Sangha also became the ones who wrote out the sutras. They memorized them, they were the scribes who wrote them out, they practiced them, they taught them to others. Okay, and so You know, the communities got larger and larger, of course, depending upon the support they received, depending upon the physical structures they lived in. In South India, a lot of the Sangha lived in caves. You know, they had all these cave-dwelling monks. In other places, they had an arama with these, you know, buildings and huts that and it's the initial word for hut was vihara. So a hut vihara initially referred to a hut. Later on, it seems like vihara became used as the collective word for avasas and aramas, you know, any kind of settled community of monastics. Later became a vihara, but originally vihara was just a hut. Okay, so depending upon the situation that they lived in. You know, this place in Afghanistan, Bamyan, that the Taliban destroyed, you know, where they had these really tall Buddhas? Mm. I was in Bamyan in 1973. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was able to see those Buddhas before they were destroyed. But what was so incredible is that whole wall, it went miles and miles, that whole cliff had so many caves in it. You know, and all these cave entrances, and, you know, I remember that we walked up, you know, and saw the caves, and, you know, we're standing on top where the Buddha's head was, you know, because there were all caves up through that side of the cliff, and these are where the monastics of old used to practice in that place, you know. It's really kind of amazing. I mean, I'm sure they kind of hewed some of them out because, you know, they were this interchaining network of caves. But, yeah. So it wasn't until maybe about the 5th century A.D. that you began to have these monastic universities that we hear so much about in the Tibetan tradition. Okay, but before that, you had these settled communities. Some of them were called Lenas, L-E-N-A. Yeah, and settled communities in different places. And like I said, memorization, you know, being scribes, teaching, practicing, educating the lay people, and so on. And because building materials weren't so good in those days, when something fell apart, you know, a monastery fell apart, they would usually just build the new buildings right on top of the old ones. You know, you didn't have to call in the, what do you call it, you know, the one with the ball that the demolition team, you know, that knocks down the concrete structures and takes it to a landfill. You know, it just crumbled by itself and you built your new building right on top of it. Okay. And then in the 5th century, you started having the arrival of these large monastic universities, like, you know, the most famous is Nalanda and Vikramasila and Odantapuri, and, you know, there's several others of them. What was interesting about these monastic universities, let's talk a little bit about why they began to be formed, okay? It was because the Brahmin class was becoming more powerful, and all these things of debate, remember we were talking about the debate starting at the time of the Buddha, there were all these different sects, you know, some were Brahmanistic and some were, you know, different religions, the Samkhyas that we all know so well, you know, were around. And, you know, all these ones, like if you read a tenets text where they're going through the Buddhist and non-Buddhist tenets, you know, they're still refuting and explaining the tenet systems of all these people who existed in India, you know, in these early centuries A.D. and also B.C., you know, because you have the Jains and the Nihilists and or Hedonists and the Samkhyas and all these other ones, Vaisheshikas, and anyway, so I jumped a whole step of history here. What do I tell you first? Okay, can we put a pause button on the monastic universities? Let's backtrack a little bit, okay? to back, you know, You wouldn't believe I was a history major, would you? You know, so after the Buddha passed away, you know, they had the first council. They started systematizing things. So, of course, everybody has their own interpretation of different things. And, of course, people want to see parallels between one thing and another. So in the generations right after the Buddha, you had the arisal of the Abhidharma. Okay, and the Abhidharma arose because you had, this was the first Buddhist scholarship, because, you know, the Buddha talked about the four of this, and the five of this, and the seven of this, and three of this, and so the Abhidharma accumulated all these different lists, and of course they made lists of their own, because they would begin to say, well, the three of this relate to the five of this by having four ways, okay, or, you know, they would take the various teachings and make many, many different points and numbered systems. You know, there's this many types of karma, you know, because they would go through the whole canon as it was at that time. And Buddha spoke about karma to these people and over here and back there. And they took all of them and made a list of all the different kinds of karma there were based on what the Buddha said, okay, in all these different places. So the first thing that happened to the teachings was you began to have systematization, okay, of the teachings, and, you know, more lists, more categories, finding ways in which the teachings were relating to each other. And then after that, you began to have the arisal of different interpretations of the teachings. And the second council was, and I should have, you know, my lack of preparing here, I can't tell you what date. Do you know what date it was? It was, I think, about a century after the first council. The second council happened. And the controversy of the second council was over Vinaya, you know, because they all had different interpretations of what they remembered the Buddha having said, and different practices. And so there was some monks at Vaisali. I remember the place. It was at Vaisali. And so these monks, they started doing 10 practices that other monks objected to. So, for example, they kept salt in an animal horn to be able to use the salt later. Or they began to accept other things besides food in their alms bowl, like gold and silver, which I find is interesting. The whole difficulty about not handling money right away, that was one of the first ones that it became difficult for them to do. So there was a big controversy about the precepts, you know, and how could you accept gold and silver? Could you store food? Could you carry salt? Could you do this and that? And so they called another big council, and some other monks who had been practicing in a different place, who were real elders, you know, they kind of broke their retreat to come to Vaisali to have this big council, because they thought it was very important that the Vinaya be kept purely. And so the Vaisalian monks, they were reprimanded and told that they were incorrect, and, you know, to go back to the traditional way to do it. As it happened, I read later that some of the Vaisali monks later on didn't accept that, you know, and so they kind of started their own little school. I think that was the Mahasamhikas. Some of these details you have to check, because I mean, not, or my sasikas. Anyway, they started their own little group, and it started with an M. And if I were better prepared, I would be able to tell you all of this, but I'm not. Okay, so you began to have some divisions there, and the initial divisions were about Vinaya, you know, and how, or about the pratimoksha, the vows themselves, and how to do them. And then, of course, you started having people developing different interpretations of exactly what is an arhat, you know, and is the universe beginningless and endless? And, you know, because at the time of the Buddha, there were all these debates going on, and the Buddha just refused to engage in a number of those debates. He said, none of this was conducive for attaining enlightenment, you know, whether the universe is finite or infinite, or whether the Tathagata exists after he dies or doesn't exist. Because the whole way that these people, formulated the questions was within the context of inherent existence, and so whatever answer the Buddha gave, the people wouldn't have understood it correctly. So there were like 14 questions which he just refused to answer. But they were pressing questions for people, so in later days, people continued to philosophize about them. And there began to be, you know, different views about different things. And so you began to have, you know, some philosophical schools that were beginning to form. But of course, at the beginning, you know, it wasn't a philosophical school. Just like at the beginning, it wasn't Buddhism, you know. Buddha had no intention to start a religion, and it wasn't called Buddhism. You know, it was just this loose group and had a teacher, and that's how everybody did it, you know. So who's your teacher? What was your dharma? Another, what was your teacher? Who's your sangha? Who's the community you hang out with? And so it wasn't a, you know, these were like common words in ancient India. And they, so, you know, Buddhism wasn't this tight religion with a catechism or anything at the beginning. There wasn't even a title to talk about it as a whole. So similarly, when you began to have these different philosophical interpretations and different interpretations of the monastic discipline, it didn't start out as a rigid school. It just started out, you know, these people, you know, there's a group over here that believes that, and there's a group over here that believes that. And then slowly these groups began to be given names, you know. And I don't know to what extent these groups even, you know, systematized all their individual beliefs at the time that they were there, or if sometimes it was people later on who looked back at them and systematized all their beliefs. Okay? But anyway, you know, you had I think the Satantrikas began to come out of there, because these were people who studied the sutras. The Abhidharmas were kind of, you know, the Abhidharmas, and then the Satantrikas came out, and they were studying the sutras, and so they became another group. And then, of course, as Buddhism went to different areas in the country, you know, although everything was memorized, there was going to be times when people's memory slipped. And so you began to have different, you know, different recitations going on of the Vinaya. And so you have this formulation of what's called the 18, you know, traditions, initial traditions. But of course, the historians cannot agree, even the Buddhist historians can't agree on what the 18 were and how they are to be classified. You know, because if you look in the back of Meditation on Emptiness, Jeffrey did some research on it, and it's like, you know, there's four major ones. According to so-and-so, there's four major ones, and these ones are the subdivisions of those. But according to so-and-so, the four major ones are different, and the other ones that, you know, or subdivisions of these, and so they can't even agree on the 18 names to start with, let alone on who's a subdivision of who. Okay? But, yeah, but I think this is natural, isn't it? I mean, human history, lack of communication, you know, people live in their own areas, they do their own things, it's entirely, you know, natural and to be expected. And what I find so absolutely remarkable is when you compare the Vinaya of some of, you know, because some of these 18 ones are no longer in existence. We don't have any texts for them. But some of them, I think there's maybe five that are still extant in terms of their texts. Can't remember, but there's only a few. I mean, maybe three that are extant in terms of their Vinaya lineage. The Mula Shavasavada, which is the Tibetan, the Dhammaguptaka, which is in China, and then the Theravada, or, you know, the Pali, which is in the Theravada countries. Okay, those are the three extant Vinayas that I know of. If I'm saying anything wrong, somebody please correct me here. Okay, I know that the Chinese had more Vinayas in their country at one point, and they have the texts from those Vinayas, because I've seen translations of them, but I don't think those lineages are still extant. In any case, you know, what I'm surprised at is, given how broadly Buddhism spread to so many different countries and the lack of communication and the lack of transportation, the Vinayas are remarkably similar. It's absolutely incredible. And His Holiness talks about this a lot, you know, in terms of the Bhikshu vows, because he says, Because what is it that Pali, the bhikshus have 227 vows, and in the Mula Shravastivada in Tibet they have 253 vows. And, you know, but His Holiness is saying, you know, what might be seven vows relating how you wear your robes in the Mula Shravastivada is one vow in the Pali. Okay, so just how things are broken down. I mean, they're remarkably similar. And it's very interesting, you know, when you think of lack of communication, lack of transportation, these people memorized things really well because there were so few changes, you know, and the number of centuries that went by without them having any contact with each other. Okay? So the first thing of having the different schools started happening in terms of Vinaya and then in terms of philosophy, you know. And again, this is very natural because people have different dispositions and different inklings. So the people who had this kind of methodical, systematic mind, they became the Abhidharmas, you know. And then the people who wanted to approach things the other way or were thinking in another way, well, you know, they were doing the Satantrika, and then, you know, other people were more meditators. And so it is quite natural that you have this kind of thing. And it's good, actually. Okay. So anyway, you began to have this development over time of different groups. Yeah. And so when the men, and then plus in Indian society, okay, now I'm going to press the pause button about how the monastic university started, is that in Indian society in general, okay, so you had all these different groups, philosophical traditions in Indian society in general, you know, and this whole tradition of debate, and they'd get together and they would debate, and of course the loser had to convert to the winner's one, mm-hmm. So you really needed to have good debaters, otherwise your whole tradition was going to get demolished. And the kings would very often be present at these debates or sponsor the debates, and so your support, you know, in society, whether you're going to get food also depended on, you know, how well you debated and expressed your philosophy. And so, of course, you know, the Buddhists got involved in all of this, and these monastic universities were formed as a, you know, as a structure to provide for that. What was interesting is in these monastic universities, they not only taught Buddhism, they taught Samkhya and all these other philosophies. Because I think the idea was that in order to refute them, you had to know them pretty well. So you had the scholars from the other traditions actually teaching in the Buddhist monastic universities. And you had not only the monks studying there. I don't think any nun, I don't know if they ever allowed any nuns to study there or not. But if, you know, you not only had the Buddhist monks studying there, but you had lay people studying there. So they really became, you know, this like a school, like a university. So this was a really big shift from a monastery, okay? Because a monastery was really centered around practice, you know, and it was only for the monastics because they were living the pratimoksha, and, you know, and it was also, you know, it was a smaller group. When you started the debating, then of course you need a very big group because you need many, many ideas and you need all these different teachers of different traditions to come. So the universities became quite large. Interestingly, the universities started out as series of small monasteries located in proximity to each other. So they didn't start out, you know, there was nobody saying, you know, there was no Mr. Harvard, you know, saying, whoever it was, saying, you know, I'm going to start this university with these departments, but rather you had all your different monasteries living close to each other. And then what happened at one point at Nalanda is they built a wall around all those monasteries all together. And building a wall, you know what happens. You build a wall around five monasteries and they become one unit. Okay, so it became Nalanda. And of course it was divided into different colleges. And it became very much for debate, and so we have, you know, these wonderful Madhyamakan, you know, philosophers who are absolutely extraordinary coming out of these universities, and we're still chewing the hard bones what they wrote. Geshe Zopa calls it, you know, chewing hard bones. And it is. So they began to be there, and, you know, and all these debates and things like that began to happen. And I'm sure that, you know, that there were still smaller monasteries where people really did a lot of practice. And again, you know, as all this was developing, even these philosophical tenet systems, you know, I don't think that they were so crystallized as we're led to believe in the Tibetan system. I mean, they did have the term Vaibhasika or Satantrika. Those terms existed. But whether they were crystallized into this kind of tenet system that we study or not, that remains to be seen. You know, and I'm sure, like with the arrival of what later came to be called the Chittamatra system, it wasn't that at the beginning a Sangha said, well, you know, I'm starting a new philosophical system and it's going to be called Chittamatra and here's what I believe. It's, you know, no, it's, you know, Nagarjuna taught what he taught, and then afterwards Sangha taught what he taught, and then people, you know, took these things and systematized them, and then, you know, enough people kind of believe the same thing and they're living in the same area and they began to be called, you know, Chittamatra, for example. And then the terms, like even within the Madhyamakans, the Svatantrika Madhyamakan and Prasangika Madhyamakan, those were not even used in ancient India. You know, those were terms devised by the Tibetans. Okay? And, you know, it's very interesting when you study the tenet systems. I've always really, I wish I had better language skills in Sanskrit and Tibetan to be able to go back and read what these guys really wrote. Because I think a lot of times, you know, words are put in their mouth, you know, you said this and this and this, so you must also have asserted that and that and that. You know, so we hear that, you know, the Satantrikas assert that the I is this, and the Chittamatra says the I is that, and, you know, the Satantrika Madhyamakans say the I is this. I don't know that any of them ever said that. But later on, people looked back and said, well, you asserted da-da-da-da-da, so you must have thought this is what the I was. Okay? Because it makes no sense at all. It was very clear that the Buddha taught anatman, you know, no self. So that a school would have said, we assert the self to be this? You know, I wonder. I don't think so. I think those were, you know, things that were devised afterwards when people studied their systems. And what I find incredibly interesting is, you know, the Madhyamakans look now at, you know, in the Tibetan system, of course, we look now at what we call the Satantrikas and say that Satantrikas, they were eternalists, they were absolutists, you know. But there's another way of looking at the Satantrikas where you could say they were nihilistic also. And what I find very interesting is that, you know, some of the Theravada monks, they look at the Tibetans and say the Tibetans are eternalists. Mm-hmm. Because we talk about an extremely subtle mind. Mm-hmm. In Tantra, there's an extremely subtle mind that goes from life to life. And they go, hey, you know, this sounds like a soul. And the Buddha taught there's no soul, there's no self. So I find it very interesting who thinks who is an absolutist or a nihilist. Yeah? So, very interesting. And, of course, a lot of this comes because people don't really understand what the other ones believe. Yeah. But anyway, you had this rise of the monastic universities. And you know, simultaneous with this, so you had the rise of the tantric system. Yeah. And I think, you know, I mean, you can see Buddhism is changing all the time as things go on. We're kind of out of time now. Maybe I better talk about how the Mahayana arose and how the Tantra arose, you know, later on. But, you know, the main point, you know, in all of this history, I think, is just to see how things developed, yeah? And to see that things are conditioned and they're influenced and they exist within a culture and they're determined by a culture. And how, in my mind, what I think is always so important is, let's go back to what the Buddha's initial intention was. you know, and not get hooked in the institutional demarcations and categories, but, you know, what was the Buddha's initial intention? And, of course, sometimes, you know, you study all these different, I'm not saying don't study these different philosophies and schools, because many of them help us to understand what the Buddha's intention was, you know. But I think it's helpful, you know, if we study many things to get a broader perspective of what was going on. You know, otherwise, I know, and I say this just because, you know, when I first got into it, the Tibetans that are not very good on history. I mean, I remember we asked them when Jay Rinpoche lived. Nobody could give us the date. Yeah? I mean, and this comes, if you think about it, you know, Tibet was never colonized. It was never colonized. So the whole thing of what the Western monastic university, where, or the Western university, how the, you know, it grew up, where, you know, we began to have history departments, sociology, psychology, political science. You know, you look at a Western university, all these different departments, and there's even new departments that weren't there when I went to school, okay? When countries were colonized, when Thailand and Sri Lanka and so on were colonized, the material from those societies went to the Western, you know, academics who talked about it and discussed it. And of course, Western academics went there, and the upper classes in those societies became Westernized, and they began to have those departments of anthropology and sociology and so on in their own countries. Mm-hmm. Well, the countries that were never colonized never developed that kind of educational structure. So even in 1959 in Tibet, there were no secular universities. Not a one, okay? It was all the monastic universities, which you could see were very copied very much from the Indian system. They don't know about historical analysis. They don't know about sociology. Yeah, they don't know about anthropology. This whole way that we have of the liberal arts field of looking at how human beings function together, all the different ways we function together and think, that whole structure never went to Tibet. Yeah? And so, of course, they don't have a habit of, you know, I mean, Bhutan and, you know, a few others wrote some histories, but history wasn't important to them. Dharma was. Okay? And they never developed this thing of a self-reflection, self, you know, how we analyze our society all the time. They never developed that, how you analyze your own society. So there was never a Tibetan who wrote a book about the evolution of rituals and where the rituals came from and how the rituals make you think and why certain rituals fit into Tibet because of the pre-existing wet culture and so on. There was they never did any study of that. They never thought in that way. Okay, a completely different way of thinking than us. So I think this kind of thing is helpful for us, you know, because it shows us how we're culturally conditioned. And we just assume that other societies think in this way, that they have a liberal arts academia that is somehow filtered down into an educated population that is capable of this kind of reflective thing. And that's totally our misconception. And the Tibetans are looking at us thinking, you know, you people, you know, why don't you have a system of religion where religion is the most important thing, and why are you so interested in technology and in building nuclear bombs to blow each other up when that has nothing to do with your future rebirth? And they look at Western society, you know, what are you guys studying all this stuff for? It has nothing to do with anything that's important. So I think my personal experience is I think understanding this helps us bridge the cultural gap with our Tibetan teachers, because we are the first generation, or now coming into the second generation. Some of you may be the second generation Western Buddhists, you know, from the Tibetan tradition, and knowing how to understand the tradition, how to understand the mental set of our teachers, how to shine a mirror back on our own preconceptions and our own tendency to be very orientalistic and study the oriental philosophies as if they were inferior because they're not as technologically as advanced as us. Because Tibetans didn't have wheels until 1959, you know, and to see our own colonialist, you know, arrogant, culturally arrogant mind as we project it onto Tibetan society or other societies. And, you know, how we were raised thinking, yes, democracy, everything's got to be equal. There's no concept of that in you know, traditional Asian societies. And we come in with our preconceptions, and how come they're doing things the way they do? It makes absolutely no sense. And they're going, how come you're doing the things the way you do? It makes absolutely no sense. And neither one of us are realizing how culturally conditioned we are and how we just have so many assumptions we project onto other people. You know, and so many assumptions that we assume ourselves are the way things exist. You know, so I think, you know, understanding all of this, is, I think it has a definite role in our Dharma practice because it really opens our mind. We don't get so angry at others. We don't get so judgmental. We begin to be aware of our own conditioning. We become aware of our own social namtok, or preconception, superstitious thought. And I think especially our social conditioning, you know, our societal namtok, this all needs to be deconstructed. I mean, if we need to deconstruct the I on a grosser level, we need to deconstruct all these cultural assumptions that we have also. And those are going to be easier to deconstruct than the I, you know, and to see those things as dependent arisings based on conception, not as inherently existent categories of society, history, political science, you know, anthropology, just categories we invented, whole ways of thinking. We invented whole ways of thinking. It's not that the rest of the world thinks like that, but we think that everybody does think like that. That's part of our ignorance, isn't it? Why it becomes difficult to generate compassion. Okay? So what I'm saying is I think this whole kind of historical, sociological, anthropological view of the evolution of our history has a bearing on our Dharma practice and the karma we create. Okay? Because if we become angry and judgmental and whatever, we're going to create negative karma because of this. Or if we become very stuck in our own cultural views, it's going to become very difficult to understand how things are merely created by term and concept. Just again, my opinion. Okay? But anyway, something to think about. Okay, so that's why, you know, I think learning and reading some of this is very interesting and, you know, very, very helpful. At least for a mind that thinks like me, and the way my mind thinks is how everybody's mind should be. Right? I'm a big namtok. Any questions? Yeah.
I have a question. We hear sometimes the causing of schism in the Sangha.
Yeah.
So I guess, two related questions. One, what is that? What does that mean? And then two, is that what happened at Vaisali? When those monks who were sort of reproved said, we're going to do our own thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, when they talk about the schism, they talk about, so your question for the benefit of the listening audience was, you know, what is causing the schism in the Sangha? I mean, is that what happened at Vaisali? The initial schism was Devadatta, the Buddha's cousin, who was trying to cause a schism in the Sangha and make them into two separate groups, you know, because he thought that the discipline should be more strict and that the Buddha was too lax. And anyway, it seemed that Devadatta, you know, wanted control of things and so on and so forth. So that was the initial schism. And of course, that backfired and it didn't go. So when we talk about the five heinous actions of creating a schism in the Sangha, that particular one is it.
So it's only done one.
Of the five heinous actions, if I remember correctly, you know, that was Devadatta. Okay. Now, creating other schisms in the Sangha, yeah, I mean, many historians call that a schism. I think we would need to understand how the different monks felt about it, whether they became enemies, whether they called each other by different names and so on and so forth, or whether it was just we agree to disagree and, you know, live and let live. Because what I also learned in my reading is that, you know, in the and this gets into the whole thing of the posada, how we do our mm-hmm. confession, there was a boundary set up, you know, and all the monks within a certain boundary had to come in, you know, and do confession together. And it seemed that at some time, you know, that there were different groups of monks living within the same boundary, and they may have had different beliefs or different interpretations, but they lived peacefully together somehow. I think they may have even come and done the posada together. And then it was later that, again, these divisions began to become more and more rigid. But I think at the beginning, you know, they may not have been seen as schisms, but just as, you know, oh, that group over there, they practice like that, and this group over here, they practice like this. You know, to me, the word schism, and I don't know if this is the doctrinal definition of schism or not, but schism implies a lot of hostility. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And there's a way to have different groups doing different things without there being hostility amongst them. Yeah.
In the Catholic tradition, the schism is like a formal announcement that you're breaking.
Okay, so a formal announcement.
Yeah, that you might be doing things differently for a while, but then the formal announcement, I think the Pope is wrong, and, you know.
Yeah. Right. So it might very well have that same, that would make sense, the same tone in Buddhism.
And something I read about schisms said that if within a boundary the monks were disagreeing so much that they did separate soja ceremonies, that was a clue. Like they could have a friendly disagreement and get it together for soja, but if it was so hostile that they, you know, separated for the soja.
Well, they couldn't sit together for the posada, the confession together, then one group had to leave and find another area, you know, within another boundary. Yeah, so that would make sense. The schism was always based on hostility. Yeah, but that there were initially, you know, different groups, even within the same boundary.
That would be sort of a lowercase schism, as opposed to a capital schism.
No, that wouldn't even necessarily be a schism. That's just human beings. Yeah. I mean, you look, Sarah has one monastic text, and, you know, some people follow Jesumpa, and some people follow, you know, Sonam Drapa, and some people follow, you know, Jangyam Shepa. There's not a schism. They all live peacefully together.
Yeah. And they do sojung together.
Yeah, they do sojung together. You know, and they debate together, and they talk to each other, and they're friends, but they certainly, you know, have allegiance to their own monastic textbooks. Yeah. I mean, whenever you have a huge group of people, it's natural to divide into subgroups. You know, it's totally natural. And that, you know, not everybody's going to be the same. And if you try and regulate things too much and make everybody exactly the same, that's when you're probably going to get the schism. You know, because some people are going to say, you're restricting me too much, I'm fed up. Just sit quietly for a couple of minutes.